Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 15, delivered on March 21, 2018. The title of this lecture is Internal Rate of Return and Net Present Value.
Today, Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return. Before I do that, get you back into the flow of looking at charts and doing some basic analytics. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates that it can raise today, signaling that it is going to try to slow down the economy. Now, as interest rates go up, pulling you back into the routine, that water. As interest rates go up, what should happen to stock prices, madam? Come on. Interest rates go up, stock prices go, asset prices go. Say it loudly.
Down.
Down. Yes. So what should happen is that the Fed raised interest rate, key interest rate, and targeted another rate for increases that it can't affect directly, but it can indirectly. And now let's look at the stock markets, the markets today, the indices. Sir, good day, bad day, or really not much of anything day?
Bad day.
It's a not much of anything day.
Okay.
Look at that. 0.18% down, 0.18% down, 0.26% down. Those are trivial. The stock market drifted today. Well, why didn't the stock market have a cow? Oh, my God, interest rates went up. Moo, we are all going to sell, 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 run for the hills, flight to quality, all that good stuff. And yet the markets did not do that today. And the question would be, why didn't they do that? And I put that to you, sir. Why did the markets not have a very down day on the interest rate increase?
They're going to write it out?
Well, that's one. That's interesting. That's a possibility. There's another answer that's a little stronger, but I'll grant you that. Madam, do you have an idea of why the markets did not react hardly at all to an interest rate increase that is going to slow down the economy, possibly set us on the course to that recession that we're teetering on? Anything? Okay, here it is. I wouldn't expect you to actually know the answer. The answer is that the markets already knew this was going to happen days, weeks ago. The expectation is already impounded in the stock prices. It's not when something happens, it's when the markets have assessed that it will probably happen. You can't act on information that's just popped up, because if the markets knew that or suspected this was going to happen, that would have been dealt with weeks ago in the stock prices. And so getting it out there in the public now really isn't going to cause the markets to react, because they already know that that is going to happen. Keep that in mind, that you can't beat the markets that way. Now, I will cover this in more detail in a subsequent lecture, but we have a model of how markets work. We call it the efficient market hypothesis. It simply says that markets impound, put into prices of securities, all the information they have as soon as they have it, or as soon as they expect it. Now, the weak form, there are three forms of this hypothesis. The weak form, W-E-A-K, says that all public information is immediately impounded in stock prices. So in other words, as soon as companies release their 10Qs, 10Ks, that's public information, that gets in there within split seconds. Now, there's a semi-strong form of the hypothesis that says all public and some private information gets impounded in stock prices right away. And then there is the strong form of the hypothesis that posits that all information, all public and all private, is immediately, as soon as it is there, it ends up in the stock prices right away. Now, where we think it is the semi-strong form. I'll give you an example. 2 weeks ago, the president announced a series of very serious tariffs on some imports from other countries. Specifically, aluminum, steel. He announced these, and it was almost like, oh, God, are you kidding me? We know from history that you start a trade war, you're going to have a global recession. In late 1920s, in order to deflect from the economy, which was clearly in severe trouble, the president and his allies in Congress passed a series of massive tariffs through an act called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. Immediately, countries around the world retaliated, and that was what sent the recession into a Great Depression. So it was like, are you kidding me? Out of nowhere, you decide that you're going to do this? Well, interestingly enough, we found out a few days later that one of his advisors owned a lot of stock in Canadian aluminum companies. And that advisor had sold his very large holdings days before the announcement, which had driven down the stock price quite noticeably. No one even was paying attention, but there it was. Some private information had gotten into the stock price before the information was public that these tariffs were going to happen. So that gives us some more evidence that the semi-strong form is there. So don't think, well, I pick up the morning newspaper and I read this and I'm going to trade on it. You got nothing. Because the minute that was on the presses, and possibly even before it became public information, the prices had already reflected that information. You're not going to beat the market. Okay? You do the well-balanced portfolio and all that, and you ride the market. Okay. Now, moving on, however, today the market just drifted because it already had that information about those things that were going on, what the Fed was going to do. A couple of weeks ago, we knew the Fed was going to crank up interest rates, and it was probably going to do it a couple of times. It's probably going to drive us into a recession. And the closer we get to that recession, the more certain the market's going to get, and the more of that information is going to get impounded in the stock prices. So if the Fed announces another rate increase at its next meeting in about a month and a half, well, probably those stock prices will already have reflected that because we know the Fed's going to raise the interest rates again. So those are probably not going to show up. What will be showing up is information that is new, that hasn't been already expected. And there wasn't anything big today, so there you go. Yeah.
Do you think the president made the right call by raising the interest rates? Do you think it was necessary?
The president didn't do it. The Fed did it. the Federal Reserve had to do it. They had been playing way too long with interest rates at low levels, and the building inflation underneath the surface is now going to be a beast that will stick its head up in its own ways, in its own time. We haven't seen nearly what inflation is going to be. They had to do it. They should have done it before now, but now they're going to do it. And it's going to be very strong. It's going to have a strong effect on the economy. And we've already seen stock prices sliding dramatically because of that expectation of a coming recession. And it's not over yet. And we hope that they are in front of it soon enough that they don't have to get overboard with it. Although I'm not sure that's going to be the way it actually works out. We hope, however, for your sake, because you're going to go out there into a job market that's not going to be very pleasant. Okay, now, something that I'm looking up some information that I put on my, I shouldn't have done it this way. No, I didn't want to do that. Great. Okay, I got some information there I'm going to have to look up here in a second that I keyed in. Okay, let me get off that and try this another way. Okay. Businesses actually are very much reflections of societies. And one thing about many societies, and we see this all through cultures across the world, there are new methods that come about. They are recognized as being the best, at least that the time says that those times say they're the best. We recognize that they're superior to older methods. But that does not mean that the older methods will still not show up and will still not be used by people of a more modern age. We see this in all kinds of ways across cultures. We still see people write letters, even though email is far more efficient. We see, for example, when I used to teach English, I would start people by teaching them some things about old, middle, and early modern English. And then I would point out to them that modern English actually still carries all kinds of little pieces of older, more cumbersome language. If you think about a verb like look, I look, we look, they look, but he looks and she looks. There's an inflection, an S, sitting there on just one possible variation on the verb. That comes from Old English, where they put all kinds of weird variations on the verbs for different pronouns and nouns and cases and all that, and moods. So we don't always have everyone on the same page. Anywhere in society, and this is especially interestingly, we see this in business. I took the classic finance courses, economics courses. I knew the best practices. When I went out to do consulting, well, I expect everyone will be using these. They've got their bachelor's degrees, MBAs, or whatever. They know best practices. I found out, actually, no. I saw methods that were repudiated years before being used in businesses. One of those methods, one way in which they were often used was in what we call project decision making. Project decision making. Imagine this. Do I have any marketing majors here? I promise I won't disrespect you. Okay, I will. Now, no. Okay, you've come up with a great idea. Your marketing analytics tell you, The company needs this product in its inventory. Clear that there's a need for it. So you collect a lot of data, focus groups, analyze price points. You come up with revenues, and then you have some people work out financials, projected financials for this project's contribution to the overall company. You go and get the information from a production's operations people for the costs of the equipment to build and make the product, distribution costs and all that. You got it all together, and you have driven it down to the cash flows, the future expected cash flows, and the cost of the project. And then it comes to me. I am the finance person, and I'm the one who says yes or no. And I use a method to say yes or no. There's no gray area, by the way, in this method, in what we do. It's either yes or it's no. Now, it'll probably be no. I don't know. But in fact, the more times I see the numbers coming at me that say yes, the more suspicious I become of the projections. The reason is simple. How could it possibly be that every brilliant idea that comes from another department just happens not to have already been found and exploited by a competitor? But that's another story. But anyway, the method we use. There are two modern methods, and then there are some old methods. When I first started consulting, the very first two consulting gigs I did, they were using an old method that had long ago been repudiated. And yet there they were using this old, bad method it wasn't killing their company, but it was just not the right way to do it. It's sort of like I say this. Look, you can use the design specifications from a 1935 airplane, and it will fly very well. But you probably wouldn't want to do that in the modern age when we've got far better ways to build airplanes. But still, the old airplane might fly, and there's an old saying, if a donkey talks to you, the first thing you don't do is correct its grammar. But anyway, let me write one down here. And I wrote these numbers down. Let's say that the cost of a project that you have brought to me is $5,000 out of pocket. So I put a negative $5,000. Now, you have given me the future expected cash flows. So, year cash flow. So year zero is going to be the negative $5,000 that's coming out of pocket right away. And then this project is going to last 6 years. Year one, $800 is going to come in. Year two, $1,200. Year three, $1,500. Year four, $1,500. Year five, $1,000. And then the project dies out at $500 in year six. And now there is a salvage value. At the end of the project of $200. Almost every project, whether it is recognized or not, has a salvage value. An amount that could be. Now, most companies and most institutions don't realize the salvage value. In other words, they don't liquidate the equipment. But it's there, whether they do it or not, it's an opportunity cost if they don't do something with it. I'm going to tell you a secret here, okay? Now, you probably shouldn't tell anyone this, what I'm going to tell you, okay? There is a room downstairs in the basement here. It's a big room. And they're going to actually try to make it into student study areas or something, classroom, something like that. But right now it's all sealed off. And it's like huge. Now, I was in there a couple of years ago. I wasn't supposed to. It was a ghost hunt. Notice how I'm covering up the microphone? Now, in that room are all of these computers, and we're talking about ancient stuff, my good man. I mean, we're talking about, remember those computers that were like big blocks? They had the computer and a little, I mean, I've got a 34-inch monitor. These were like 12-inch monitors on some of these, and they were using things that I don't know if some of you have ever even seen. Have you ever seen a floppy disk? I'm not talking about those hard shell things. I'm talking about the ones that were this big that go, wah, 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 wah. We used to play Frisbee with them until we realized how expensive they were, especially the double density disks of the age. They took those, the hard drives. I mean, the hard drives back then were stupid expensive. I mean, people buy hard drives, what, like a terabyte? We're talking about hard drives that held 10 megabytes that cost $5,000 back in that time. We're talking about modems. You guys, I've got internet speed of 150 megabits per second. The modems back then, some of them were real blazers, 12K. I mean, it was just awesome. I mean, I was a badass. I mean, I had a 12K modem. I had 640 megabytes of RAM and all that. Now I've got like 24 gigabytes of RAM and all that. Anyway, all that equipment's down there. It was never liquidated, so it just sits there. You see, that equipment could have been sold in the time. It was out of date when they upgraded over the years, but you could have at least donated it and taken a tax credit for the donations of it to schools or to second or third world countries for schools for the kids. But it just sat. And I've seen this in many universities, just these rooms full of ancient computers and other technologies from other ages, from other times. Instead of dumping it out, getting rid of it, and realizing salvage value, they got nothing. But that does not mean there was not a salvage value. Now, here's how you do that in this cash flow statement. All you do is take that $200 and put it on your last year's cash flow. In other words, the last year six is not 500, it's 500 plus 200, 700. Do that right away. Now, some of the problems that you're going to encounter in your assessments, they'll say the salvage value is zero. Sometimes they'll say it's a positive number. It always adds to the last year's cash flow. Yeah. No, go ahead, please. If you have to pay to get rid of it, oh, yeah. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually an interesting thing. Sometimes you need to get rid of stuff that's going to cost you to get rid of. A great example of this is something that has become hazardous waste or is in some way you're going to have to pay specialists to move that stuff out of your company's ownership and liability structure. That's excellent that you're asking that because sometimes it is a negative number and they don't recognize that at the beginning of a project. They don't even think at the end of this, we've got this nasty stuff that we've got to get rid of and we're going to have to pay someone to take it off our hands. And again, toxic waste at the end of a project is a good remediation at the end of a project is sometimes something that you have to deal with. Another thing, interestingly enough, is when you shut down a project, that can sometimes be when your problems really start to begin with people who say this product injured me. We stopped making it 5 years ago. 20 years later, oh, I'm dying from this product. So you've got to bring those into it. And that, are you a finance major?
No.
You need to be, okay? You have a very cynical, hateful outlook on financial problems. I like that. That's good. Okay. But yeah. Oftentimes, companies will, they just throw stuff away or they put it somewhere, out of sight, out of mind, and then like 20 years later, what is all this stuff in this room? Well, that's from, you know, when we upgraded our computers, where we upgraded our telephone systems, and you got all these telephones sitting around with old technologies. See, and they lose value if you just let them sit there. Those computers down there now, they are going to be a cost because they are considered hazardous waste. If we had gotten rid of them at the time, we could have pulled a few bucks off them or at least gotten some PR value out of giving them away. Okay? Now, I mean, no one's going to take one of those computers. Okay, so now, again, though, we put this value, positive or negative. And so that 6 goes from 500 to 700. Now, the first method I'm going to show you is this old method that is inappropriate, but it is still used, as I found out myself. It's called the payback method. Now, the payback method begins with a problem. I want you to pull a number between 1 and 5.
2.
That was very good. I mean, you didn't even hesitate. You're going to make a good decision maker. That was a bad decision, but it's a good... Okay. No. Okay, here's how the payback method works. All you do is you say, all right, we are going to set the number of years, the payback period. All projects have to pay for themselves within 2 years. You just say that. Now, let's look at this project here. It's cumulative positive cash flow. At year one, it's 800. At year two, it's 800 plus 1,200 is 2,000. At year three, it's 2,000 plus 1,500, which is 3,500. At year four, it's 3,500 plus 1,500, 5,000. At year five, it's 5,000 plus 1,000 is 6,000. And at year six, it's 6,000 plus 700 or $6,700. So in other words, this project pays for itself in 4 years. So we reject it because our policy is that it must pay itself back in 2 years. This is surprisingly a common method, and it's just wrong for two reasons. One is always this payback number of years is just pulled out of thin air. It's been decided years before. No one knows why it's there. There's no justification other than that we want any project to pay for itself within 2 years. It would be like we want you, madam. I'm your father, which should scare you. But I expect you to pay back the cost of everything that it has cost you from your prenatal on through. I have a payback period of 10 years. So if you don't recover all my costs by the time you're 10 years old, you're gone. Okay? Okay, yeah. Okay, that's, well, why 10 years? Dad? Okay, 12 years. Sheesh. I mean, you know very well, you're not going to pay back everything. Well, you won't. Don't worry, it's okay. They'll die, and then they won't hold a grudge against you. So the thing of it is that, you see, this is just pulled out of thin air. And there's another, one of the appropriate methods even has a hint of this out of thin air in it. The second problem, which is more finance, is that they are treating future cash flows as having the same value as a present cash flow. $800 in 1 year is not $800. It should not be compared to that now negative 5,000. You have to discount it back. And 1,200 is most certainly not the same as 5,000 because that 1,200 is coming 2 years in the future. So its present value is considerably less than that 1,200. Even more so for the rest of those because their value is declining the farther out in the future they are. So the payback method is actually terribly flawed, but I saw it, and whenever I tell you something from my experience, it's always anecdotal. It's, in other words, it doesn't prove anything. It's evidence. But a study was done a couple of years ago. It was a survey of just a lot of large and medium-sized companies. And and one of the things that they wanted to find out was, what method are you using for project decision making? A surprising, something like 25% of all the companies responding said they're using the payback method. That's what they're using. In other words, it's wrong. It's long ago. I mean, decades ago it was repudiated. We haven't been teaching that as an appropriate method in undergrad or grad programs, MBAs and PhD programs, for decades. And yet it is still being used as the standard in about 25% of the companies. So again, though, does that mean these companies are all going to die because they don't use the best? No. Companies tend to have ways to get around the flawed methodologies they use. And sometimes we have to recognize that even an older method can actually lead to successful results, provided that there are other mechanisms within the decision-making environment that get them to the correct answers that they really should use. However, the problem is that in the modern age, in the 21st century, our competitors are right at the edge using the best methods. And especially in other countries where they have extraordinarily strong discipline in their workplace behaviors and in their academic institutions, we're coming up against people who know how to do this stuff right on the money. So the looser, sloppier methods, they will get us bitten in the butt the longer we go into this century. So keep that in mind. And again, I've seen the payback period method in my own consulting. It's still out there, apparently, even all these years after I saw it. Now, an appropriate method. Best practices, there are two. They are interrelated, but one is better than the other. It is not, one of the methods is solid. It should always be used. The other method is shaky, and it can get you to some wrong results if you're using it in the wrong place or in the wrong way. Surprisingly or unsurprisingly, in that survey, it was the method that can sometimes be shaky that was more popular than the method that is accurate. Okay, so keep that in mind. And there's a reason for that. And the reason isn't a good reason, but it's out there. And I will explain that as we go forward. First, however, I want to tell you how to do this the hard way. And I'm not even going to go to the end and do it the hard way. I'm going to show you the hard way. And then I'm going to pull up this very fancy, modern thing you might have heard of called a financial calculator. That thing right there. See it? That is unbelievably efficient in getting the answers. The first method, the one that is the best of the two best, is called the net present value method, NPV. Net present value. It's calculating it can be a pain in the dairy backside. Okay. I'm pulling it out of thin air right now, but I will show you in 2 weeks how we get this one. It's called the capital asset pricing model, but for now I'm just going to pull one out of the air. Suppose that we discount future expected cash flows from this project at a rate of 8%. And again, right now, I'm pulling that out of thin air. Don't worry, though. I will show you how we can get this number. It's really actually not that hard. But this interest rate, as you know, interest rates reflect risk to a certain extent. They're actually a metric of risk, like a beta is. As a matter of fact, beta is used to calculate the discount rate. But the higher that interest rate is, the riskier the project. The lower it is, the lower the risk. So here I've got a project with a rate of 8%. And I compare that to the discount rate for safe and risky projects. And that might be a little bit on the risky side for the current environment, but we'll let that leave that for another time. But here's how you do it. Mathematically, arithmetically, I would simply find the present value of each of the component cash flows. See that $800, that $800 1 year out? I would take that $800 and discount it back at 1 plus, divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the first power. That would find its present value. And then I would add to that the present value of the second year's cash flow, 1,200 divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the second power. And then I would add to that the discounted value of the third year's cash flow, which would be $1,500 divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the third power. And then I would add to that the discounted value of the fourth year's cash flow, $1,500 divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the fourth power. And then I would find the present value of the fifth year's cash flow, which would be 1,000 divided by the 1 plus 0.08 to the fifth power. And then I would take that last one, 700 divided by 1 plus 0.08 to the sixth power. I would add all of those up, and then I would compare it to the cost in the here and now, the $5,000 negative. If I get a positive, I say yes to the project. If I get a negative, I say no to the project. It's as simple as that. You notice, however, that doing all of those calculations, if you're like me, you're probably going to make a mistake. You can do it in an Excel spreadsheet, kind of avoid some of it. But one way or the other, and if, of course, in the accounting courses, you would find the present value factors in those tables in the back of the book. You remember doing that, which is way too much like work for me. Finance people tend to be lazy. Okay. Or you can get your calculator out, your TI-83. You see that thing right there? Now this is going to impress the whoopee-doo out of you. Watch what I'm going to do. Turn on the calculator. Are you ready? I'll let you get ready to get your calculators out. Now here we go. I'll wait until you all get it out. You ready? Now, apps, finance, go down or just key in 7 or go down to 7 and hit enter. That's NPV. If you hit enter, you return to the front screen with NPV open parenthesis. Now the first thing you're going to do is you're going to key in the discount rate, 8. Don't do it as a decimal. Remember, this is a finance app, and almost all finance apps, unlike real math, use the percent instead of the decimal. Now, you've keyed in the 8, put in a comma. Now you put in the negative initial cash flow, negative $5,000, and put it in as a negative. Now you put in a comma, and here you put in second brace, open brace. That's the one right over the parenthesis sign. And then you just key in each of the cash flows. Positive cash flows, 800, comma, 1,200, comma, 1,500, comma, 1,500, comma, 1,000, comma, 700. Now you close the brace, second, close parenthesis, then you close the parenthesis you opened at the beginning. Just close the parenthesis. Now hit enter. That did the whole thing. That whole calculation there, it did it. It's $184. That's a positive number, so we accept the project. We accept it. If it had been negative, even $5 negative, we would have said reject it. Even if it had been $2 positive, we would have accepted it. It is that black and white. Yes or no? Okay? That's how you do this. Yes? You son of a... You know what? I'm going to punish you by explaining the economics of what you just asked. If you come to me with too many positive NPV projects, I'm going to know that you're inflating your cash flows, positive cash flows. I would be much less surprised by a zero or a negative than I will be by positives. Here's why. If I keep getting positive NPVs, marketing and production and all the other big idea people keep coming up with great projects that are positive NPV, I'm going to say, why the hell has no competitor ever penetrated this market and sucked up all the cash flow already? Why is it that you've had these visions of all these projects, products, marketing campaigns that are can't lose in a competitive world like we have, where no matter what you think of, some son of a dog has already figured it out? That's the problem with too many. At best, I should be seeing a lot of zeros or very close to zeros. If I see wildly positives, why hasn't anyone ever come up with this before? Why are we so special that we're getting these large positive cash flows out of this project that was so obvious to us, but it wasn't obvious to all of these greedy, hungry competitors who never saw it coming? You got to give me a reason for that if it happens. So your question actually carries weight. I should see zeros. In other words, projects probably, a lot of projects should be near zero because someone's got to have thought of this. If you're coming up with all these genius things, it was like I showed you earlier in the semester. When they came up with the genius idea for the sports arena, they were talking about revenue streams. We'll have a market for our arena, our convention center, our arena, our sports thing that'll go 60 miles in diameter. Really? You're saying that you're going to get mom and pop kettle from the country and you're going to suck seats from the venue at Peoria? No. They were dreaming from the very beginning. And that's why their cash flows were so high. That's why their finance people found that it was a positive NPV project, when what we've seen in retrospect is that it was a dog, a bad donkey that is sucking money out of the city. So there you go. That's your answer.
You accept it or not?
Don't. Okay, here's the economist would say, I would be indifferent to the project. But you see a penny on the ground. Are you going to pick it up or not? You're not a finance major. A finance major would say, of course you'll pick it up. Now, that depends on your socioeconomic circumstances. I would pick it up. Now, if a $100 bill goes by, are you going to go after it? No, and you'll probably, yeah, you will. And probably it'll go out into traffic and you'll be at, meh, meh, ding, ding, ding. But Bill Gates wouldn't. I mean, that would be 1/2 of his income for the year. You see, it depends. But you see, in finance, even tiny positive is still worth, if you're sure of yourself that it is that tiny positive, you're still going to go for it. And that's just because it doesn't matter. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. The greatest success stories in business, not just in this country, but all over the world, are not the ones who come up with genius projects. They retire in 2 years selling their products at thousands of percent margins and all that. The geniuses are the ones who know how to make a tiny fraction of a penny off a billion of the pieces of the product. Candy. Little tiny piece of candy, you're not going to make hardly anything off a single piece, but if you can addict an entire nation to those sweets, then you're going to make yourself a fortune off those tiny little sweets. Go.
I had a question about the discount rate. How'd you go with the 8%?
I pulled it out of my ass. Okay, however, I will show you how to do it the right way in a subsequent lecture. It's called the capital asset pricing model. And it actually involves the beta. And it's not hard. I mean, it's probably one of the easiest formulas you'll ever see in finance. But we will be able to calculate this very soon. Now, I'm going to show you a couple of things. One's quite practical in the calculator. But the other thing is a little bit more abstract, at least at first. Let me draw this. Now, on the vertical axis, I'm going to be plotting net present values. On the horizontal axis, I'm going to be plotting discount rates. And I'm going to go from 1%, 2, 3, 4, 5%, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. 11, 12, 13, 14, whoops, it's a little too tight there, 15%. Okay, so now on the vertical axis, I'll go, let's say, 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, positive. And then go the other way, negative 100, 200, 300, 400, negative 500. Okay, so now what I've done here is I've actually calculated a point. For this project, at a discount rate of 8%, my net present value was $184, right about there. I mean, I'm just eyeballing. Okay, now, I did my calculation, I'm the finance person, and then you quickly run up to me, madam, and say, oh, you did it wrong, I meant 9%. You calculated it's supposed to be 9%. Oh, Lord, okay. I guess I have that turned off. That calculator just turned off on me again. Why does it do that? Anyway, okay, on. So I have to go back through and do this whole stupid calculation again? No, I don't. Watch what I can do. Second, enter, and your calculation's guts come back to you, and you can then move through and edit any number you want. So I'm just going to write over the 8 with a 9. Did you see what I did there? Okay, let me make sure you all know how to do that. Just hit second enter and it copies it over. Okay, now, enter, Ooh, it's still positive at 9%. Well, I'll be darned. 9%, it's $32, but it's still positive. So in other words, at 9%, we still have a go on the project. Well, let's try that again. Let's see what happens at 10%. So you got to be a little careful here. I'm going to go second enter, and that will open the formula up for editing. Go back up and go over to the 9. Now, the first number that you key in, it'll just overwrite. So I'll type the 1, and then I have to hit second insert to move it over so the next number crowds everything out. You overwrite 1. But then if you want to get any other numbers in that you don't want to overwrite, you have to put second insert in there, okay? Now watch. Oh, what, negative 113, reject at 10%. So at 10%, we're down there. Well, a little up from there. Look at that. That is, oops. The net present value function. It's downward sloping. In calculus, we would say the first derivative is negative. And this way, once I have it, I can sort of like eyeball any NPV for any discount rate. But there's one there that's quite special. There's one there that's actually quite special. Do you see where this function crosses the x-axis? Right there? That special value. Now, if you remember your algebra, where a function crosses the x-axis is called the root, or the roots of the function. You remember, find the zeros of a parabola and all that kind of stuff. This is the crossing point. This thing is called the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. It's a special place. This drives the second decision-making method in best practices. The problems, there are two problems. With using the internal rate of return method, there is one problem that begins as a theoretical issue from algebra, but it has very important practical implications. The NPV function is linear when there is only one change in sign of the cash flow. See that project that I'm talking about here? It changed from negative to positive, and that's all. That was the end of it. However, if that had had more than one change in sign, the NPV function would have not been linear. So, for example, if the change in sign is once, the NPV function looks like that. Twice, it looks like that. Three times, it looks like that. If you remember from your algebra, polynomial theory, first degree equations cross the axis once. Second degree equations cross the axis at most twice. Third degree equations cross the axis at most three times. It's a way to get to just a general idea of what the function looks like just from the degree of the polynomial. In other words, the highest power to which the x occurs. That means, more than anything else, practically speaking, if you have a cash flow that switches sign more than once, the calculator will give you an internal rate of return, but it will mean nothing. It is completely irrelevant. It's a spurious result. Here's why. You see, suppose that I had an NPV that switched signs twice. I'm sorry, a cash flow that switched signs twice. It would look like that. The NPV function would have a very odd behavior. So it would have two roots, one here and one here, two internal rates of return. Neither have any meaning. Even worse, though, is calculators, when you tell them to find something very complicated, they use what is called a numerical method, usually what is called an iterative method. It's the same thing we used to do back in the day before calculators to find the internal rate of return. They would take a guess. The calculator takes a guess. Oh, NPV is positive, so we're going to have to move to a higher discount rate. Oh, here it's negative. And then what it would do is it would just keep calculating back and forth at extremely high speed until it got to zero NPV at a certain decimal place of accuracy. That's how calculators do it. But you see, depending on where this calculator would begin to look for it, would decide which of those internal rates of return it would find. If it began to look way up there, it would find the higher root as the internal rate of return. Doesn't matter. Neither of them has any meaning financially. They just are not meaningful. So that is the practical side of it. And realistically, a lot of projects, you start with a lot of money out of pocket. Then you build revenue, and then a few years later, based upon your marketing data and other things, okay, we're going to have to spend more money on it. So you'll have a negative year of cash flow. And then you'll begin to have positive years again. So in the real world, you're probably going to see a lot of projects that have a switch in sign more than once in the cash flow stream. And that means the internal rate of return is going to give you meaningless results. Okay, now, take the other side of it. There's a way around that, by the way. It's called the modified internal rate of return. But there's another problem. The way internal rates of return are often used. It's called the hurdle rate method. I'll just show you an example of it. Let's say our hurdle rate for projects is 10%. What this would mean, and many companies do this, they say we will accept no project that has an internal rate of return of less than our hurdle rate, in this case 10%. So what that would mean, practically speaking, is in a situation where, let's say, we've got four projects we're considering. Project A has an internal rate of return of 13.5%. Project B has an internal rate of return of 8.0%. Project C has an internal rate of return of 7%, 0.0%, and Project D has an internal rate of return of 15.0%. Okay. This would mean that we would reject Project B and Project C because their internal rate of return, rates of return didn't meet the hurdle rate. Here's the logic of what it, here's the logic of it. Okay, 1%. I'm going to do the discount rate axis. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Eleven, 12, 13, 14, 15%, 16, etc. Okay, now. Going on out a little further, I guess. 17, 18, 19, 20%. Okay, here, look. Here's what's going on. The hurdle rate that has been set by the company is 10%. Now let's look at the net NPV profile of A. It's 13.5%. So in other words, that one crosses the x-axis right here. So its profile looks like that. That's Project A. NPVs, downward sloping. Project B is a classic NPV profile, but it does, that's it crosses the x-axis at 8%. That's what the internal rate of return of 8% means. It crosses the axis at 8%. Notice for Project A that at the hurdle rate of 10%, Project A is still a very positive NPV project. Do you see that? Make sure you see that. Project A, it doesn't go negative until 13.5%. So at the hurdle rate, this company has set at 10%, this thing is still a home run. Project B, on the other hand, by the it crosses into negative territory at an internal rate of return of 8%. So Project B would be a no-go because by the time it gets to 10%, it's a negative, it's a dog. It's gone. Similarly, with Project C at an internal rate of return of 7%, Project C, by the time it gets to 10%, it's even worse on an NPV. But Project D at 15%, at 10%, that thing is massively positive NPV. So that's the logic of the hurdle rate. The problem with it, where does the hurdle rate come from? It's just pulled out of thin air. Just last month, I was having a nice dinner with some executives, treasury people from a company. And we were talking about this class, and I said, yeah, a couple of weeks, it gets a little bit better, right? I said, at this point, they're in the dark, hard part, and then it comes up, and it gets a little easier with NPV and internal rate of return. And one of them brought up hurdle rate. He said, well, you do teach hurdle rate. And I said, yeah, do you use hurdle rate? Oh, yeah. And I said, well, what hurdle rate are you using? 12%. And I said, 12%? When did you start using that? Neither of them could even tell me. One guy had been there 12 years. The other guy had been there 8 years. And they'd always use a hurdle rate for projects of 12%. I said, so you're not adjusting? You don't know when or why it was made 12%. And it's never been adjusted like in a low interest rate environment? Wouldn't you want a lower hurdle rate? Like now, in low interest rate environment, wouldn't you want a higher one when interest rates were very high? Well, no, we just always use 12%. We calculate IRRs, and then if they're above the 12%, we say yes. If they're below the 12%, we say no. And I said, you've always done this. Even when interest rates now are way down there, you don't adjust the hurdle rate. And you don't even know where the hurdle rate came from that you're using, who decided that. No. Is there a problem? Well, they were paying for dinner, so I said, there's not a problem. That's just the reality of it. I mean, it's a really bad method. Now, here's another weird thing. Suppose you had two projects you're looking at, but you couldn't afford to do both of them. And this happens, surprisingly. Project A and Project B. IRR and NPV. Project A has an internal rate of return of 17.68%. Project B has an internal rate of return of 19.21%. Project A has a positive NPV of $8,562. And Project B has an NPV of $6,998. You can choose only one of those two projects. In other words, you can't afford both of them, or they are more likely they're mutually exclusive. You'd have to use the same resources, so you can't do both of them. This happens. This is actually not that unusual. That you see, by the IRR method, you would choose Project B. But by the NPV method, you would choose Project A. So which one do you choose? It's NPV, because it does not have the theoretical or practical flaws of the NPV method, of the IRR method. Just because internal rate of return is weaker and has places where you don't use it or shouldn't use it, and NPV doesn't suffer that flaw, you always would choose if the results are conflicting, in this case, go with A, because NPV dominates. It's just like with beta and PE ratio. Unless the PE ratio is insane, if the beta is telling you one thing and PE is telling you another, you go with beta because it's a stronger method. Okay? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.